as you may or may not know. WFMU's website broke a few days ago and remains partially broken now. However, we have put things together with some horse glue and sticky tape and fixed it. Please go to the address in order to reach WFMU's live streams, playlist and chat pages. The address is freeform.wfmu.org. Again, freeform.wfmu.org.
I told him.
This is the movie.
Deal.
Hollywood doesn't want you to see.
Scary.
Welcome to another episode of Tectonic, usually with Mark Hurst, but this week filled in by me. Hello, my name is Dan Morfitt, and you might remember me from an episode of Tectonic in April of 2025, where Mark and I talked flowingly about dystopian movies. Are they a mirror to the future, or do they create that evil future? And whatever we said on that episode of Tectonic, we never revealed the twist in Soylent Green. I don't know how you can spoil a film so old, but please don't eat Charlton Heston. On that episode, talking about movies, I thought when Mark asked me to take over this episode, oh, I'll talk about Google and Silicon Valley, but that's not my wheelhouse. I'll stick to what I know nothing about. I'll stick to movies. And so this week, my guest is John Ashbrook, a film writer, a film lecturer, a script writer in the UK. John, aggrandise yourself. Just
greetings. I'm English. I don't do self-biggery. I'm English. Thank you. As you say, a lifetime ago, I was a film reviewer on the radio, on the BBC. I have to stand up and salute whenever I say that. I've written for several magazines. I've written a load of books about films. And then I sort of stumbled into teaching film studies. Yeah, I mean, a love of film and a love of communicating what's good about film is kind of my defining characteristic, I guess.
With all of that, John and my paths crossed many, many years ago at a radio station. And in 2006, we did a podcast, which was right at the dawn of podcasting, right in those early troglodyte days. So much so that the media conglomerate that we worked for didn't know how to upload them to the internet or sell pre-roll ads. But we digress. John, the question on today's Tectonic is, will tech save the talkies? Because cinema, ever since it was invented in, 1895, as that train careered out of the screen and the whole audience left screaming, cinema has been dying since the day it was born. And every other day, we hear from the entertainment sheets in Hollywood and across the rest of the world that the cinema is dead. Do you agree with that first concept? Well, is cinema dead?
No, because whilst obviously you could make the philosophical point that it's been dying since it was born, it's also been growing and evolving since it was born, which is just a different perspective on the same thing, I guess. It depends on how you define cinema. And I would say the cinema is, as we historically have understood it, is a gathering place where it's a place where people go to be together to experience a storytelling spectacle. It's the village hall. It's gathering together. It's, you know, to some people, it's the church. It's a place where you go to worship your chosen deities. You know, a few weeks ago, we all went and we worshipped in the church of Tom Cruise. So, you know,
let's not get mixed up with the church of Tom Cruise, because that could lead to other recriminations that I don't even want to gather. The man is an icon of the silver screen, and he's OT7. But so I think we can both agree that the concept that the cinema is dead because Hollywood say it's dying. Hollywood does have this self-perpetuating thing that, we're about to end. The business is about to end. And
The business as the people who work in the business now, and by which I don't mean the creatives, I mean the executives, I mean the people who actually get the money and the flash cars and the big houses for doing very little, they say it's ending because the freeloading gravy train that they have been on for decade after decade after decade is grinding to a halt, and they haven't got the vision to know where to go. All they can do is do what their forefathers did, is repeat things that worked in one way or another in the past. I offer to you the blight of 3D that Jimmy Cameron brought back into the mainstream about 15 years ago. That was first used 70 years ago as an attempt to fend off television. It's a thing that they have done before. And we are in a world now where everything is changing so rapidly that these people who often inherited their jobs from their relatives have got no idea what to do next, because the nexus is moving from the film industry to the technology, to the tech bros, still in California, but I gather a bit further north.
So you touched on something there in that cinema has seen this perceived threat before, because radio didn't kill the newspaper, TV didn't kill cinema, and video didn't kill the radio star. But those are all blithe comments. But it is that thing that, 70 years ago, tech was used to try and entice people back into the cinema. William Castle was famous for putting buzzers underneath people's seats and pumping mist into a picture house and then getting people to run around dressed as ants to scare them. That's no different, is it, to 4DX, where you're sat on a chair that moves. It's basically a roller coaster in a static, darkened room.
Yeah, but people still like theme parks. People like that idea of a simulated physical experience. And if you can attach that to a story, and also you can do it indoors in comfort, then why not? But I think the important thing is, it needs to be attached to a story. Historically, cinema, film is a storytelling medium rather than just a spectacle. And I think that during our lifetimes, and certainly during our awareness of movies, ever since 1977, when Star Wars set the template, films have increasingly been about spectacle and less about character and storytelling. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing, but it is something that feeds into this idea of making cinema into a 4D experience of blowing smoke in people's faces. But it's not the be-all and end-all. It's not the only type of cinema out there. It's not the only type of story to tell.
You've touched on so many things there, John. First of all, the 3D thing. I remember when 3D was literally thrust into our faces. The irony. Many, many years ago, they made us buy 3D Blu-ray players. They made us go to the cinema and wear those funky Roy Orbison-esque shades rather than the blue and the red glasses of yore. That was a hot thing for a hot minute. And I know Marvel went all in on 3D, but all it meant is that pointy, jabby sticks came out of the screen rather than moved on the story. You also moved on to Star Wars, which is now owned by the House of Mouse. George Lucas infamously used so little tech in 1977. Most of the great vistas that you see are matte paintings and people throwing splint at glass and then it all like cascading into beautiful explosions. It was very low tech. And this is the guy behind International Light and Magic. This is the guy who basically invented modern day CGI. Yet when I watch something like 1977's Star Wars, I refuse to call it A New Hope, that's revisionist, the effects there were better than anything CG that we see now. It's like the CG world that we see in our faces, in our screens, on every movie now. It's that thing of Uncanny Valley. We know the magic behind it now, so much so it's not magic, it's just
I think there is a danger that we're going to turn into old men sitting on park benches waving our sticks at the young whippersnappers, because I don't think that we can objectively say that the effects in Star Wars better than the sort of effects you get nowadays, simply because we knew they were effects, whereas nowadays you can't tell where the effects are. But the flip side of that coin is that when we saw an effect, we were impressed by the fact that it was an effect. And nowadays, because everything's invisible, you're not impressed by the achievement. So, as I say, a few weeks ago, I went to see Mission Impossible, and without giving away any spoilers for anybody who hasn't seen it yet, but as has been heavily featured in the marketing, the sequence when he goes wing-walking on a biplane. And I watched that entire sequence, and it's a long sequence, and I thought, well, isn't this the helicopter chase from Fallout, where he's up against Henry Cavill? It's very similar to that. You know, there was a sort of real case of deja vu, even though this was done for real. There's no special effects involved. It was all done for real. And then when you go onto the YouTube and you watch the making of, and you realise just how difficult and dangerous this was, because there was nobody else in that plane. It was just him on the wing, and he was having to run the camera himself and all that. But you don't get that appreciation from the film. You just get the spectacle. And I think that there is we've got to the point now where we've got to a state of diminished returns with spectacles, in that we've seen everything. We've seen, you know, planets explode. Anything less than that, and it's just meh.
And so is it the audience being the problem? It's not the tech or the improvements, and it's not the storytelling. It's just us, the audience. We just need a little bit more to be impressed, enthralled. I don't know.
No, I don't think the problem is with the audience. I think the problem is with the way the filmmakers, and again, I'm not necessarily pointing the fingers at the people who are actually on the coalface making the films, more the producers who are making the decisions about what's going to be made. I think that they sort of misunderstand what the audience is looking for in a film. The lesson that Hollywood learned from Avatar was that people want CGI pointy sticks pointing out at them. The lesson they didn't learn is that the audience wants a completely convincing, immersive, three-dimensional space creative that they can sink into, that goes off into infinity. They learned the wrong lesson. And I think that's very often the case, that the people who are in the executive seats learn the wrong lessons from technology, and it's the artists, the directors, the writers, the actors, the people at the grassroots who are in touch with the fans, and are indeed fans themselves. They take the technology and do new and exciting things with it. And I think we can look right back at the introduction of sound. The thing that sound brought in was it essentially ruined cinema. It made it far less visual, because before sound, we'd got cameras moving around, waltzing everywhere. We'd got incredibly visually audacious filmmaking, completely immersive. And then as soon as we had this new technology of sound, we had to worry about people not being more than 18 inches away from the microphone. And suddenly everybody was standing still around tables with bunches of flowers on. There's a wonderful sequence in the Gene Kelly film, Singing in the Rain, about the rigors of trying to create sound. This sequence was almost rebuilt in Babylon, the Damien Chazelle film a few years ago, about the limitations that sound brought. But then the artists thought they dealt with this obstacle, and filmmakers like Ruben Mamoulian started including scenes in his films where the cameras did move, and there was a fluidity, because he said, well, let's add the sound afterwards. And so, you know, there are ways around the technology. I don't think the people who are creating the technology, and I don't think the people who are financing the technology, know how to use it. I think you need to give it to creatives, and they will find things that the audience do want to see.
Is there always a lag between the technology and the application of it? Is there always a lag between amazing innovation and then appreciation of that? And I say that, you know, very subjectively. I really enjoyed a film called Better Man It's a biopic about a British pop star called Robbie Williams that America doesn't know or care about, which I don't blame them necessarily, but I like him. The film is a biopic, which you can only do so much with. I think biopics were ruined by John C. Reilly and Walk Hard because they amped up the cliches. But the thing with Better Man as a film is the main actor is a CGI monkey. You know he's a CGI monkey, but he has all the emotion, all the expression. The things that people like Andy Serkis and Weta pioneered with their Planet of the Apes films is being put into telling a lad's story about becoming a pop star in the body of a monkey. And it was so underappreciated at the box office. I think it may have got one Oscar nomination for a song, a couple of Golden Globe nods and stuff. But when storytellers have that opportunity to use tech, there does seem to be a lag between our appreciation of it. It's like Avatar. Yeah. To me, I didn't enjoy Avatar. It was basically a remake of Fern Gully, but with those glasses and sticks being prodded at you. But it's immeasurably the biggest film of all time. Never the best, but people wanted to go and see that spectacle. So I think what I want to move the conversation onto is then, if it is all about the storytelling, how is tech a wonder? How is tech going to be used in the hands of the creatives? And when I think about this, I think of somebody like Steve Soderbergh, who was one of the people who latched on to the power of videotape early on. Sex, Lies, and Videotape was his breakthrough. And he also then moved into the world of filming entirely on an iPhone. I think this got a lot of press because Apple were going, see, you can do movies on this. The rig around the iPhone was actually quite massive, and the lenses used and the constant power and the data banks, as it were, saving everything. But does it take time for the creators, the creatives, to get that tech and use it to how they want it to be made?
I think one of the things with tech, and an iPhone is a good example of this, is the tech keeps changing. Every year they bring out a new model, and that suggests that the previous year's model, they actually suppressed some of the things they could put in it because they need to put stuff in the next year one. So 28 years later, that was shot on iPhones. You know, there are sequences in it which were shot with, I think, 28 different iPhones all arranged in a semicircle so that we can do what used to be called bullet time, is swooping around an image. So that way that Danny Boyle could pick out the angle that was best for the storytelling. That has actually been quite slow to be adopted. But then filming on video, or filming digitally rather, that was adopted very slowly. The Phantom Menace, God help us, was the first film ever shot entirely digitally. And everybody said that Lucas was mad. But then back in the 70s, when he was making this kids film featuring lots of characters wearing masks, talking made up languages, everybody told him he was mad then as well. The adoption of making films digitally happened very slowly. It's almost ubiquitous now. I know Technicolor have almost shut up shop because nobody needs film anymore. And yet at the same time, we've got filmmakers like Christopher Nolan and like Ryan Coogler and Christopher McQuarrie using IMAX and making parts of their films big and spectacular with IMAX. And IMAX is a bit of a throwback because it's a film medium. It's not a digital medium. So there are times when different technologies, almost different periods of history, are operating at the same time. So we've got, you know, IMAX, which is, I think, back from the 70s technology, you know, so 50-year-old technology. And then we've got this year's iPhone all being used to essentially produce the same type of thing. Now, I think the future isn't necessarily going to be people gathering into one space and all facing in the same direction, watching the same image. However that image is produced, whether it's produced on film or video or animation or live action, I think that there's going to be more branching in the future, and cinema is going to become more of a mercurial beast. There's going to be different types of cinema experience for different audiences and possibly different ages.
And you touched upon IMAX there. I remember being young when it was a specialist thing, sort of seen in museums. And now these Canadian overlords have basically got an IMAX screen in every multiplex. And it is that weird dichotomy between seeing something on not just a big screen, but a giant screen, and then also being happy to sit at home and not watch it on your giant 80-inch OLED screen, but happy to watch it on your 4x2 mobile phone under the covers. It seems to be a weird thing that we, more than ever before as a consumer, have every format available to us.
Yeah.
And we take every format and we accept every format. There is no snobbery about it anymore, which then there could have been a 10, 15 years ago.
Absolutely. In fact, through the entire history of cinema, there's always been this cold war between cinema and TV. The idea of an actor appearing in a TV, of a reputable cinema film actor appearing in a television series, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, it just never happened. It was considered career suicide. And yet now a lot of the big Hollywood movie stars appear in and in many cases produce TV shows because they know that that's where they can get to do a bit of really cool acting, get their teeth into a good solid role because of the quality of television production now. So that's changed. And obviously those programs, by definition, you watch at home, whether you watch them on your mobile phone or your laptop, or you watch them on your wall-mounted surround sound telly, it's still considered television, even though a lot of that television looks more cinematic than a lot of cinema does. And then at the same token, you've got a range of cinema experiences. There's the 4DX. I don't know if this is anywhere else, but in the UK, the Odeon do this thing called iSense, which is, I think, done with lasers. And obviously, we've got the various different forms of IMAX, some of which actually are IMAX, some of which aren't, presenting films as spectacle. And because this is the most recent one that I've seen, then I'll just mention it again, that the Final Reckoning, the sequences in the biplane really do give you a sense of vertigo. They make you feel sick when you watch that on an IMAX screen, because the whole point of that 4x3 almost square screen is it fills up all your peripheral vision. So all you can see is the image. It doesn't do the letterbox thing that most films do of focusing your attention on that one eye level image. It just fills your screen and it's a spectacle. The only downside of that is you're not really paying attention to the characters and the narrative and the nuances of the storytelling. You're busily feeling sick in your seats.
I think one of the biggest innovations then in tech from the formats is probably the kitchen, tightening the experience. I go to an Alamo Draft House or a Studio Movie Grill where you go to the cinema and you get drinks where you're sat and you're watching a movie. So it's a bit like being at home, but also in a shared experience with a few other 100 people, and everybody's having very delicious flatbreads, salad, and IPAs. So maybe that's a tech innovation. We've moved away from the microwave, and we're going up to the full-powered oven and chefs. We've got to take a break halfway through this episode of Tectonic. Will tech save the talkies? I think we've sort of already answered that, but one of the greatest images in recent cinema that I'm going to touch upon with this tune now is Inglourious Basterds, a Quentin Tarantino film where the assembled Nazi dignitaries, including Adolf, are in a French cinema house watching this film about Nazi war hero. And then the celluloid behind the screen comes alight.
Say these eyes so green, I can stare for a thousand years, colder than the moon. It's been so long. I my blood enraged. It's just the fear of losing you. Don't you know my name? Well, you've been so long, and I've been putting out fire with gasoline. Heart that can never mend, these tears can never dry. A judgment made can never bend. See these eyes so green, I can stare for a thousand years. Just be still with me, you wouldn't believe what I've been through.
Cat People Putting Out Fires, David Bowie on Tektonic. My name is Dan Morfitt, guest hosting and filling in for Mark Hurst, who will return to the chair next week. Today, though, I'm talking with John Ashbrook, a film writer, a film lecturer, a script writer from the UK, with the overarching question, will tech save the talkies? And we've already answered that. Tech won't save the talkies. The talkies will never die. It's all about the story. But tech, John, tech could ruin it. Tech could try and implode the talkies. Tech could try and ruin movies forever. And I say this from the viewpoint of, I remember very vividly Microsoft and what's the guy in charge of Microsoft? The specky guy, Bill Gates. How could I forget that beautiful face for just a second? Wanted to make web TV a thing in the 1990s. And it never happened. He wanted to merge the television and the computer monitor, and it never really happened. And then it took somebody like Netflix to come along and change not just the fact that we watch movies and TV shows through our connected TV screens, but he also changed the distribution method and ruined studios and the like. And now we have things like the Meta Oculus, I think it's called the Meta Quest now, this headset, and the Apple Vision Pro that makes you look like a very poor relation background artist in Ready Player One, one of the worst films Spielberg ever made. I think cinema now is not a battle of creatives, of storytelling. I think that will always remain. It's what tech will get there first and who will adopt it, not the quickest, but in the best way.
And I think that a lot of that decision-making will be made by the end users. Because, you know, when I was a young whippersnapper and I wanted to be a film director, there were a few things standing in my way. One, I wasn't related to a film director. And two, I'm in England and there isn't a film industry here. So I ended up working in radio and becoming a film writer instead. And I'm really happy that I did. Nowadays, people who are sort of like, you know, teenagers into their 20s, if you want to make films, there is nothing stopping you because you don't need to have thousands of pounds to rent the machinery. You can use your phone. You don't need to hire a studio to edit it. You can use your laptop. You don't need to strike a deal with a distribution company. You can put it on YouTube. You don't need to spend millions of pounds and hire Saatchi & Saatchi to do your marketing. You can use social media. So you can get your story out there and you can use the technology. And historically, recently, we find that whenever if you watch what's happening with AI, then there's hardly a week goes by when there's not another world-shattering revelation.
Well, Google have just released their new AI model, and it's mixing lifelike and beyond uncanny valley avatars, lifelike broadcast quality sound, vision, speech. And what a lot of AI has constantly got wrong recently, text, rather than it looking like glyphs from a starship 3,000 years back in the past, it looks like typeface. Are you saying that the democratization of making a film is making it easier?
I think so, yes, because as we know, the ability to make a film, as in the ability to get a film made and distributed and, you know, with all the production, you know, nightmares of that and all of the legal issues and all of the expense, and the ability to actually make a good film are very different things. So a lot of the times you see a film will get released and it's absolute chod. It's terrible because the people who made it have got the ability to get a film made and get it out there. What they haven't got is the ability to make a good film. However, using the kind of technology that you can get for free, you can make all those mistakes. You can learn, because the point of mistakes is you learn from them. And YouTube is full of people experimenting, figuring out how to make films better. Was it Talk to Me, a horror film, came out a couple of years ago, made by a couple of guys from Australia. The one with the ceramic hand when you took shit, you talk to a ghost. I know you don't do horror films as such, but that was made by two guys who'd spent years, their entire childhood, making films on YouTube using, you know, domestic technology. And they learned how to make good films, because it's not just about how to use the technology, it's about how to use the technology well. The most important part of a film production process is the cheapest part, which is the writing the script. And that's the part that Hollywood seems to have forgotten how to do.
But isn't it quite sad that you say it's the cheapest, because anybody can do it? But then, because anybody can do it, Hollywood, and let's use that as a wider term, sees it as being cheap. So writers aren't getting paid what they deserve anymore, which is why... They never did.
But, you know, maybe one of the things, and the thing is all to play for at the moment, maybe this new technology, maybe the ability to use AI to do the work of actors and to do the work of directors and to do the work of editors and to do the work of musicians, maybe that will mean nobody values any of it. And then nobody will get paid. And wouldn't that be wonderful? Everybody is poverty stricken. So I don't know. I very much see it was inevitable that we would start talking about AI. I very much see AI as a double-edged sword. I am both gobsmacked, which means amazed, by it, and terrified of it in roughly equal measure. And I the things that it can do are amazing, but of course what will happen is the people who care about the money, the executives in their suits, the ones who inherited their jobs from their parents, all they will see is an opportunity to save money. So whilst these tools will empower more people to get into film production, video production, become documentarians, become filmmakers, storytellers, influencers, it gives them the power to do that. At the same time, it makes it harder to make money doing that.
And Tectonic and Mark Hurst has spoken to much better placed individuals in the AI sphere than you or I, John. But yeah, the speed of change is massive. The thing with AI that I appreciate, and I think any film lover might appreciate, is it's basically the sum of everything that has gone before us. And that's all good movies are. They pick and pillage, and some people call it inspiration, some people call it theft, of everything that has gone before. Is that a good or a bad thing? Because aren't we getting to such an information overload where we don't know where certain shots or certain twists in a plot or certain characters might be inspired from, just because there's just so much of it. There's so much, I hate this word, content. But we are at such a place now where content is different from art.
Yes, it is. And no, it isn't. Because Michelangelo needed to have a patron to pay him for his content.
A Patreon? Michelangelo was on Patreon.
he was on the medieval version of Patreon, you know, in order to produce his content. Painters, sculptors, musicians, Beethoven needed to have somebody to pay him in order to create his content. Yes, we see that content as art, and we don't see Mr. Beast's content as art. But, you know, there is a case to be made that they are essentially the same thing, in that you are creating something that somebody else is paying you for. Looking at music's a great example of this as well, in that it comes out in genres. There's an awful lot of music that sounds very similar to my wrinkly old ears. Pretty much everything in the chart, using all the auto tunes and all the same samples and all the same drum loops, all sounds very similar. It's all produced in very similar ways. And since Star Wars in 1977, films, certainly mainstream films, certainly tentpole films, have become much more templated, in that they are all essentially the same.
There's a formula.
There is a formula. It's called Save the Cat, and you can buy it as a book, and it tells you exactly how to structure your script. The inciting incident has to happen on page 12. There has to be a reversal at the beginning of act 3, where somebody who you thought was dead comes back to life, or somebody who you thought was a friend betrays you. There has to be a countdown at the end, ideally on screen, so that you can feel the tension and all. And everybody slavishly follows this template. In which case, it's very easy for AI to follow that template too, because there isn't a lot of creativity. I suppose there is creativity in how do you make the template new and fresh? Well, the AI will eventually get to the point when it can make the template new and fresh. At the moment, it's just slavishly copying. So that isn't inspiration, that's just theft. But within the film industry, and I would say within the music industry, they've basically set their stall out now that everything is so similar and so regimented and so templated and so cookie cutter that they are inviting a machine to come in and take over. What AI will not be able to do is innovate, is come up with something new, is present to people something they don't know they want. That you still need humans for.
Well, this is a really nice callback to the David Bowie song that we played earlier, in that that's in a Quentin Tarantino movie. When Tarantino came out with his movies, mainly being non-linear, people thought this was an absolute revelation in filmmaking. But all he had done was study Asian cinema, many, many Japanese films. Famously, Rashomon doesn't look, it's not a linear film, it's just a film from the different viewpoints of all the characters in the film, all seeing different things. So tech doesn't have to save the talkies, does it? It's the creatives just picking and choosing from other nations, other creatives.
Finding new things to be inspired by, new ways to tell stories. They always argue there are only so many stories, you know, man versus God, man versus man versus woman, man versus nature. So, yeah. But then again, you know, there are only so many notes on a keyboard, and that hasn't stopped us finding a billion different ways of playing those notes. There's a billion different ways of telling those stories. All the technology will do will make it easier for some people to tell those stories, make it easier for people to consume those stories. It'll change the way people consume those stories. I mean, moving forward, we'll have a lot more personalization in terms of you'll get people watching stories and they can choose which character they see it from, or they can...
Are we moving to a choose-your-own-adventure type of movie?
I think that'll certainly be experimented with. And as we've discussed, you have to find your moment, the right creative telling the right story at the right time. That might take off.
I say that, John, because Netflix have just abandoned that interactive strand. They have.
They got rid of Black Mirror Jabberwocky because that was another one of those pioneers. That was Soderbergh with his iPhone. That was something that was a brilliant idea that came too early. That was the band Ocean Colour Scene. They arrived too early. If they'd arrived 5 years later, there'd have been Oasis. I don't know if that's something that'll try to happen in America.
That's a very scary thought. It's like someone who tried to do it differently a few years ago was a startup called Quibi. Quibi was this brand new streaming service where they had made and formatted great, not television, not movies, but content. And I use that pickedly. That's not a word. But they created this platform called Quibi where you watch things not in widescreen, but in portrait mode. And you could choose the ending of some of these things. It wasn't exactly linear, but it failed. It died a death very, very quickly, despite having some of the big hitters pinning their hopes on this. People like Katzenberg, who used to be with Geffen and Spielberg and DreamWorks. But I think that was another case for tech and Hollywood and Silicon Valley sort of merging and trying to put the cart before the horse and not realizing the audience doesn't want that yet. They're ready for it. They just don't want it.
And yet that's what TikTok is.
Yeah.
TikTok is 9x16. It's portrait. And that was initially user generated. I was having an interesting discussion not so long back with somebody, and they were saying the key to using, we were talking about marketing on TikTok and how to do it. And they were saying the key to understanding TikTok is to realize it's not a social media, it's an entertainment platform. People don't, generally speaking, I mean, obviously there are millions of people creating content for TikTok, but there are billions of people just looking at that content. They're not there to interact. They just want to watch something that switches their brain off for 10 seconds. And that, it's going to be interesting to see how that generation, I'm very, very, very old, but I was last week I was talking to some people in their 20s, and they were concerned about their younger siblings who are sort of have got TikTok attention spans. And they said the thing is, they can't, like, not only can they not read a book, they can't read a comic. They haven't got the attention span needed to concentrate for 5 minutes, let alone hours. And that's going to impact on their education. And that's going to impact on the kind of stories that they want to consume. You never know when your Gen Zs and your Alphas become the dominant market. Are they going to want to go and sit and watch a 2 hour, 50 minute Tom Cruise film? Some of them obviously will, but will enough of them? And so cinema may change in that sense, in that we may see the end of the full length feature film, and we may be paying to go and sit in a group and watch shorts, in which case there can be dozens of performances a day. And, you know, films could be making vastly more money than ever before. As I say, everything's up in the air at the moment. We don't know how the chips will fall because there are so many new competing technologies and so many more opportunities that they offer to creative people. It's going to be fascinating.
The more things change, the more things remain the same, is the old adage. It just depends where they're going to put the on and off switch for it. On that, we had friends over here in Jersey the other week, and they have an 11-year-old son, and seeing how he used a phone, and to him it's not a phone. I don't think it has a word. It just is, which is highly philosophical. One of the main things he was watching with his friends at the same time, live, people playing Fortnite. And I was thinking, you're not playing Fortnite, you're watching other people play. I have good friends who work in the e-games arena, where they go to stadiums in Poland, and it's full of around 40,000 people there as audience members to watch teams play Call of Duty. Are all of these things cinema as well? Because if we go back to the very definition that you said at the start of Tectonic, it's this communal experience. It's this church hall, this village hall. It's all being there to enjoy a story. So maybe it's not that tech can save cinema or change cinema. It's just what cinema is different now.
And I think tech, we typically think of the bleeding edge of tech. Tech has to be the new thing, the next thing. But we are living in a world where there are a large number of people who are deliberately listening to music on vinyl, you know, on technology that's nearly 100 years old, because they insist, wrongly in my humble opinion, that it sounds better. And that's why they're happy to pay four times as much for it. There are people now who are collecting audio cassettes again. You'll remember audio cassettes. A lot of the people listening to this won't have a clue what we're talking about.
No, they will do. And mini discs.
Okay.
And digital audio tapes, which I also liked. I've literally seen a wax cylinder player.
These old vintage heritage technologies continue. They become niche and they become cultish in that sense, but they exist. They are not mainstream. I mean, there's nothing to say that they won't become mainstream. Maybe they will, but they remain niche. These technologies remain niche.
You could also say radio.
You're not wrong.
The old technology and podcasts are the new technology, even though I've always said that there is no difference between podcast and radio. No. All that's different is legally on the radio, you can't say as much as you can say on a podcast because there's too many of them.
Yes, exactly. No, and you've always made that point. And, you know, and the great thing about radio is now you don't have to listen to it live. And you can listen to radio from all over the world because the technology has allowed you to access this vintage notion in a completely new way. So maybe cinema will become a niche thing. Maybe we will get boutique cinemas, you know, like, you know, your Alamo draft houses and things like that. And maybe that will become the normal. And maybe your multiplexes will disappear and be replaced by VR headsets or people actually, you know, living inside three-dimensional films like Ready Player One.
Implants into our retina direct.
Yeah, I'm sure Elon Musk is working on that now. I'm sure he must be.
That's an image because, no, let's not go there, Dan. Litigious people might be listening. This has been Tectonic. I have been Dan Morfitt filling in for Mark Hurst. Mark will return next week. My guest this week has been John Ashbrook, film writer, film lecturer, script writer. John, I just want to sort of circle back to the very beginning of this 60-minute missive. Will tech save the talkies? One-word answer. I'll let you stretch to the three.
Yes and no.
Oh, great. I gave you every option available there. I think this has been a great topic to talk about because it always creates arguments and we may have been wrong and right with all of our wibblings. I just like the fact that right now I'm sitting in New Jersey. Modern Hollywood, modern filmmaking was created up the road by the Barrymore dynasty in a place called Fort Lee. And then some guys from Poland came across. They changed their name to Warners. They were brothers. And they moved to a brand new land on the west coast of America where the sun always shined. And there was land aplenty that could be bought and made into vast sound stages. They could even film westerns there. They could fill up giant holes in the ground as pools and make them look like seas and lakes and oceans. And now there's brand new film studios opening up in Las Vegas soon, again with Warner Brothers and some Japanese people called Sony. So I think it always changes. John, thank you for joining us on Tectonic this week.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
And on that last point, let's hear a song that talks about Hollywood. John Lydon, Left Field, Open Up, Tectonic. Left field, John Lydon, open up. Burn, Hollywood, burn. This has been Tectonic. I have been Dan Morfitt. Mark Hurst returns to his show next week. WFMU, East Orange, WMFU, Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at wfmu.org.
Welcome to yet another installment of It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here bringing you this show every Monday evening at 7 p.m. Thanks for joining me. We are going to update the playlist here. Okay, done. We're going to start with tonight with some music from France. This is going to be a group called Gru Gru, G-R-U. GRU, the second U has an umlaut. Just want to be very precise here. I'm going to hear a track from a disc released about 10 years ago called Pendulum, and this is what it sounds like. This is the group Gru Gru. And music from the French band Glou Glou, with an umlaut over the second U. That's not the track that I intended to play, but it's fine. And it was proggy enough to pass on this show. And the most important, the title of the track that I played is much longer than the track I intended to play, so this makes a very simple track listing much more difficult. Mais avis qu'on va l'abandonner sur l'autoroute was the track we heard from an album called Pendulum from those folks. They're from Montpellier, France. And we're going to go now to, I think these guys are from Illinois. This is an American group. I think they're from Illinois. And this is a band that that my daughter turned me on to, DJ Val. She was listening to this group who are called American Football. And we're going to hear a track from their self-titled album released in 2006. And I caught this track. And the thing about it is, a while back, I played a song by Jethro Tull or someone, and I said that it's a kind of a complicated song. And someone said on the comments board, "What do you mean, complicated song? This song is in 4/4. And the thing is that you can play in a simple meter, a simple musical time signature, and just mess it up, make it complicated, make it difficult. You don't have to be playing in like 17/16ths or one of those odd